My job is to introduce the first keynote, and it goes by the alluring title, Be Careful What You Ask For. You'll find in the program at the back biographies of all the speakers. I won't read them all, but I will tell you that I didn't have to be careful what I asked for when we invited Jonathan Zittrain to come and speak. I've heard him speak about this before. He's a man of tremendous insight. He's also a lawyer, despite it all. But he's also a professor, and he's the only professor I think I've met at Harvard who's professor at three different schools. The Kennedy School, the Law School, and actually where he's plays his role as lawyer, and then the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, where he's a professor of computer science. So that combination seems to be just about perfect, and our job today is to turn him into a geospatial scientist as well. So Jonathan Zittrain.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Kevin. The role I feel like I'm playing today, especially as a lead-off speaker, is to be feeling like I'm speaking from the past to the future, which is now the present. And I was struck by Kevin's invocation of an inflection point, and one of the secrets that I realized is when I was puzzling through one of Ray Kurzweil's presentations about the singularity and how we're really now almost there, everyone, I finally realized what was bothering me about the presentation, which is that on an exponential curve, the inflection point is at each point along the curve. That's what makes it exponential. Wherever you are on the exponential curve, it's an inflection point right there until a while later when that inflection point seems somewhat minor since, after all, it's exponential. Now, the relevant of that to this is that often when I think of internet topics, internet is pretty cutting edge. There's a ton of stuff going on that has made it as a field, whether studied through policy, through law, through computer science, is something really interesting. But it feels a little old-fashioned as I see what Peter was describing Kevin sensing about the fact that geospatial stuff is just about to take over. And most of what my thoughts are present in kind of the consumer space, internet users, rank and file, because that, in fact, is what drove internet, both computer processing back from the 70s, networking through the 90s, and then cheap sensors into the latter day. Each one of those revolutions was driven by rank and file people adopting and then hungrily embracing and extending these technologies. So, anyway, I'm coming from the perspective at the moment then of the past saying I want to share with you some of the kind of toughest dilemmas that we saw as we were thinking about the growth and mainstreaming of the internet, roughly starting around the turn of the century, decade, and millennium, the early 2000s, with a look about how those now are playing out today and maybe a thought about how they might apply towards the geospatial stuff for which we're at an inflection point now. This guy is named Joseph Gutnick, and in the year 2000, Barron's Magazine, a branch of Dow Jones, published an article about him. Now, he lives in Australia, has many business interests there, but he's a global kind of guy and has quite a lot of wealth and relationships around the world. The Barron's article about Gutnick was not very flattering to him. Because I am standing on territory that is the United States of America, I could tell you more about this article, even if it didn't make Mr. Gutnick very happy. If I happened to be standing in Australia, I would have to be either more circumspect or leave very quickly after the talk to avoid possible civil law repercussions in a suit for defamation. Now, where was Barron's, which is a corporate entity, when it published worldwide this article saying bad things about Mr. Gutnick in the year 2000? Well, they're based in New Jersey with the rest of Dow Jones and said, come and get us here if you don't like what we did. Gutnick was not ready to do that and sued them in Australia, saying, you sent copies of Barron's digitally to Australia. People consumed it there. I think they had a subscriber base of a whopping 7 people. That's not 7% of something. 7 people in Australia read Barron's and paid for it at the time. There were paywall issues then, there are now. But that was enough, perhaps, to give Australia the jurisdictional hook to say, not only will barons have to answer here for what they said about Gutnik, but they'll have to do it under Australia's law, elements of which might well run contrary to the American First Amendment framework and wouldn't be permissible to advance in the U.S. Here's a second example, also from the year 2000. A guy named Craig came up with the idea of circumventing the multi-layered complex contracts by which people playing football and other things are shown to your eyeballs over a screen, and got the idea of setting up antennas in Toronto, Ontario, that would catch broadcasts there and then would make them available on the internet for anybody to watch, with advertising helpfully provided around the frame of that stream by iCrave TV. His ideas in the year 2000 went, not a bad one, except that the powers that be, the NFL, the broadcasters, and others, utterly objected to this and said that it violated American law. And the response by the iCrave TV people was, who cares? It doesn't violate Canadian law, and that's where the antennas are, that's where our servers are, people are coming to see it. On application for a temporary restraining order, the very earliest phases of a case, which the powers that be chose to bring in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, USA, they said, so long as any American is viewing it, it's like one of the seven barons subscribers in Australia, the U.S. is a perfectly good place to have it here. And during the midst of that, iCrave TV set up a barrier that said, before you watch our stream, please enter your three-digit local telephone area code. And if you typed in 416, it would say, great, here's your programming. And if you typed in 617, it would say, I'm so sorry, that's an American area code. We can't show you iCrave TV. Would you like to try again? And that did not impress the judge in Pittsburgh, and the TRO issued. And it turns out that Mr. Craig and most of the principals of iCrave TV had not undertaken to move themselves to Canada to start this company. They were still happily living in the United States. And you kind of, at some point, have to put your feet where your mouth is and absent yourself if you want to avoid the reach of the court. And iCrave TV today, not a household name because of that result. So just with those two examples, let's look at what the state of play was, thinking about the intersection of multiple and often conflicting legal frameworks around the world and singular internet-enabled broadcasting and other interactive stuff happening then and now. And you basically have, I think, the basic problem of it's a global internet, but you've only got local law. And so you end up with disadvantaged defendants. You can think of iCrave TV, of Gutnik, of others who say, look, I don't want to have to answer to or in, sorry, defendants, not plaintiffs. So defendants include Craig from iCrave TV, and they include barons from Dow Jones. And they say, why do I have to go to Australia just because I put something on the internet and it caused trouble in Australia? That's not fair. It's far too far to go. And maybe barons can afford it. They're barons, after all. But regular people, bloggers, others can't. And it would just be awfully strange if by the act of expressing yourself online, you're somehow opening yourself up with no more to systems saying they've got a claim on you, your money, even your person, should it be something criminal. And that led to thinkers in each sovereign trying to figure out, well, when should we relent? When should we hold back on asserting our jurisdiction over somebody? Now, some answer might be never. Whenever we want to, we will assert our jurisdiction. That has been a somewhat broad view of jurisdiction. We've seen it before. Just ask General Noriega about the United States' view of jurisdiction when, as the president of Panama, he found himself sheltering in the papal nuncio and having rock music blasted at him until he came out, and then had to simply answer as a common drug defendant in Miami federal court for activities he undertook in Panama that were said to have an impact on the United States. And the basic idea there is you can shoot the cannonball in Panama. If it lands in the U.S., we're going to come after you, and you can't be like, don't blame me. I only set it in motion. I'm not the laws of gravity. It's like, well, you knew them, and you fired, and it landed. That's an example of using impact as a basis for jurisdiction. Other, more restrictive, might just be presence, and that's Craig being in Pittsburgh in order to have the courts go after him, even if his company was operating in Canada. There's also the problem of having to answer to everybody's judicial system at the same time. There are instances of drug advertisement online. You're a pharmaceutical company, you have a drug, you're trying to explain what it does, and in one country, you must discuss several applications of this drug or you're withholding information. And then in another country, it turns out that you may not mention this use of this drug because it is not approved by the FDA for that use here in America. Therefore, you can't even say that it can be used for that, even though any physician may prescribe off-label the drug for that purpose. We don't want that information to pass from pharmaceutical company to the ears of an American. You can see how, if you're building the website, especially circa 2000, what is a well-meaning drug company to do? So you also then have disadvantaged plaintiffs, and the disadvantaged plaintiffs are the Gutniks of the world and the NFLs and the broadcasters that basically say, what do I do when the people doing bad things to me are far away? I can try to sue them locally and indicate the cannonball landing, but if I can't actually get them or their assets or their engineers, whatever it is, in front of the court, I don't have the Marines at my disposal to blast music at them. I'm as good as powerless, and that's a problem. And a great example of that, again, from the turn of the century was this. This is the Principality of Sealand, an abandoned anti-aircraft platform just off the coast of England, where a guy named Roy Bates dubbed himself in the late 1960s Prince Roy. He worked at a shellfish processing plant on the coast by day, and at night went to Sealand and declared it a sovereign principality, and immediately commissioned its national heliport, pictured here, which is also the nation. So you can see, all right, now I've got Sealand, what do I do with it? They issue commemorative stamps and coins and identity cards, and you can also buy a lordship, I believe. So possible nice Mother's Day gift. Somebody wants to be a lord of Sealand. They got the idea ultimately, after repelling an invasion of German businessmen that you can read about online, that they should actually put into these pylons servers and have the servers be a host for information that might not find refuge elsewhere. It could be a data haven. And in fact, a company was started called Haven Co., for which the idea would be that any data could live there except data that broke the laws of Sealand, and Sealand had very few laws, and, you know, checkmate. This was the perfect thing to strike fear into the hearts of potential plaintiffs worldwide. Now, I think with the distance of history, we can see why this was a great law school textbook hypothetical. In fact, I once wrote a textbook for which I put Sealand on the cover after securing permission from His Highness to put the photo in, not wanting to be taken to Sealand and have to answer for that. And yet, when you think about it a little bit more, the whole point is we live in an interconnected world. Sealand is itself on the internet only thanks to having bandwidth that it purchases or otherwise arranges for somebody. That entity can be pressured. And you have the Craig to Canada problem of somebody might put the data there. Can you imagine, by the way, going to the corporate board meeting saying, don't worry, everything is especially safe. All of our data is on Sealand. Like, that's probably not a great recipe for a successful board meeting. But even then, so long as you're not on Sealand, if somebody subpoenas the information, you're welcome to say, sorry, it's far away, but you are not, and they can put you in jail or something until you turn it over. For this and many other reasons, Sealand never quite took off, and its heliport indeed remains closed to all businesses. So this vision in the year 2000 of, wow, this is going to be a new libertarian future, was pretty much a decent Wired magazine article, but nothing that impacted the global development of the internet and didn't make for the puzzle that we saw directly. Still, the ability to have stuff located anywhere and have it be to a user still one click away meant that Russia, Kazakhstan, you name it, different places could host stuff, and it could be awfully hard to figure out who was behind it, so it was harder to find than the person that you'd want to try to pressure. So One way to try to solve the dilemma, the underlying dilemma of a global internet and local law is simply to say, well, why not just have global law? If we can make it consistent worldwide, problem goes away. Well, that's true, but hard to do. We've only seen in the past 30 years a few examples of trying to do that. One is through a complex web of contracts, norms, and procedures for disputes over domain names in certain top-level domains like .com. There was back in the day, McDonald's didn't realize the internet was happening, and so a journalist was able to register McDonald's.com for free and then tell McDonald's that they had to donate to a school in order to get the money, the domain name assigned to them. Princeton Review found its domain name registered by Kaplan.com, a competing company. Kaplan wanted a case of beer to give it to them. Princeton Review sued, leading to the wonderful quote that says, they have no sense of humor, no justice, and no beer. So the Uniform Dispute Resolution policy was meant for the purpose of establishing one way of settling domain name disputes without even having to find the person who registered the name. You could kind of sue the name itself, and if nobody stepped forward to defend it, all the better for you. And judges could be selected, lowercase j, very lowercase j judges, arbitrators from around the world who would then decide on basis of, is this being used fairly? Has it been registered in bad faith? Whatever that means. And if the decision went the wrong way, the domain name would be reassigned. Now, of course, the secret to making this kind of universal law, whatever it's effective, is that the property in question is digital property, and you don't need the person who quote-unquote owns it in order to argue about it or affect its transfer. So the dice are already pretty loaded towards global law there, but it is still an example of some way of aggrieved people having a virtual forum to get real remedy while having basically a global framework for doing it. The other example would be trying to harmonize more substantive law, so that wherever you are, you don't end up with the Australia-U.S. divide on defamation. For copyright in particular, there's been a lot of effort, and this is in the wake of the iCrave TV case, of looking to get different jurisdictions simply to have a common baseline, and then going to Canada doesn't help you anymore. So in certain areas, copyright being one of the prime among them, we see that kind of harmonization taking place. Now, the other idea would be to say, well, why not localize the internet, and then we can keep local law? So instead of making the law global, make the internet local. And this we have seen really take off over the years. So one way that's done is at the source. I call it the check-a-box solution for reasons I'll explain. But another great historical and still, I think, very useful example is that of Yahoo Auctions. Yep, Yahoo used to run auctions. For all I know, they still do. I think 7 people have used it. But among the things advertised on Yahoo Auctions were Nazi paraphernalia, Nazi coins, daggers, stamps, stuff like that. And trade in that collectible is basically unremarkable in the United States. In Germany and in France, there are restrictions that long-standing on the display of such things, the transacting in it, and the display needed to make a good auction entry about it. So a nonprofit in France brought suit under the French legal system against Yahoo France, saying that they shouldn't be supporting these auctions because it violates French law. Basically, here we go again. Now, the French court did a very interesting thing that neither the Australian nor American courts in the earlier examples did. They commissioned 3 internet experts to tell them, how possible is it for Yahoo to figure out whether visitors to the site were coming from France or coming from somewhere else? And the reason we ask, they said, is if that's easy to do, then we can come up with a Solomonic solution to this problem. We're just going to tell Yahoo, if you see French people coming, don't show them this auction. Anybody else, you know what? Whatever you want to do, that's the rest of the world, we're France. You know, common French solution to things. And the experts came back, and sort of in a way that was kind of like, you're ruining it for the rest of us. This is why we can't have nice things. They told the French court, you know what? With accuracy that we would categorize as good enough for government work, which I think has been found by scientists to be 80% accuracy, 80% accuracy, we can more or less tell you where somebody's coming from. Can somebody go to great lengths to hide through VPN or some other technology where he or she is geographically? Yes. IP addresses weren't specifically meant to be geographic, but by happenstance, they're not very portable, so they are, and therefore, you could have Yahoo pretty reliably doing that. The French court then felt, with that report, it had license to tell Yahoo, just because we tell you you can't do this doesn't mean it affects the rest of the world or gives you that impossible pharmaceutical company dilemma. In fact, the next time we see a pharmaceutical company complaining, we'll tell them, figure out where the person's coming from. And if they're in France, obey France law, French law. And if they're not, if they're in America, show them whatever the Americans say you should show. Cry me a river, R.J. Reynolds, Altria, that you have to change the labels on your cigarettes when you sell them in China because they have different regulations. That's called doing business. And under our post-Westphalian framework, each state gets to say what happens within its borders. So that was the outcome of the case. Yahoo decided it wasn't worth the effort to have people figuring out not who was French and who wasn't. That turns out to be very obvious. But rather to figure out what's something that French law doesn't like, namely a Nazi display. So they just said, you know what, we're just going to make a new Nazi, a non-Nazi memorabilia rule full stop and not do this halfway solution. And the rest is history. Yahoo Auctions no longer a household name. So third-party companies came about to make geographic zoning more easy on the web so that anybody with a website could, with a third-party API call, figure out, I got an IP address, I don't know where they're from, you know, Quova, you tell me. And Quova would come back and say, here's based on the IP where we think they are, we update this all the time, now you can decide accordingly. As a result, over the intervening years, we see more and more, instead of, for example, worldwide intellectual property copyright contracts that used to be very localized, realizing which way the wind is blowing and going global, we see the opposite. We see those contracts still retaining regional windowing. Summer happens in the southern hemisphere at a different time in the north. That blockbuster movie not going to be released in Australia, with some notable exceptions recently, like Game of Thrones. But the technology has evolved and the business practices evolved to allow things like this. We at Showtime express our apologies. These pages are intended for access only from within the United States. That's what I saw in Britain when I tried to watch something on Showtime. Similarly, when I was in Britain one day, I went to MTV to look at something. Copyrights restrict us from playing this video outside the U.S. Great use of the passive voice, as if there's this copyrights hemming them in. But in some ways, there are. And this was very interesting, where the New York Times did an article about a very high-profile criminal case taking place in Britain. And under British law that has something to do with the rights of the accused and not having too much bias against that person, we saw a rule that says the press isn't allowed to do a bunch of pretrial publicity with allegations against a defendant. I know this is like laughable in the United States. Like, that's all there is about defendants pre-trial here, but it's a different regime. So the New York Times consulted its lawyers, and without even getting anything communicated to it from Britain, they decided that if they detected you coming from Britain, they wouldn't show you this article about this British case. This arises from the requirement in British law that prohibits publication of prejudicial information about the defendant. So we have tons of prejudicial information about the defendants that we have in this article. We're showing it happily to Americans and to British people who happen to be in America, but not to the Brits. And it's just fascinating to think. This is a really interesting example of zoning where there are millions of people who can see this trivially and other millions of people who cannot. And we think of that as not too leaky a sieve such that it might be worth it to do this. And today we see exactly the same kind of argument coming about as Congress is considering at last making it possible for states to tax out-of-state retailers who sell stuff to in-state people. They fire the cannonball in that somebody has purchased. The person receives the cannonball, signs for it, is very happy. But the state isn't happy because it can't get its tax because the retailer says, you can't get me. Congress is saying, okay, you can. And one of the complaints that says, wait a minute, now we have to be R.J. Reynolds and calculate the sales tax and the scope of it for every single jurisdiction. How could we possibly do that? The answer comes back with, metaphorically, quova. There's going to be some API you can use to say, it's a fleece jacket, it's coming from here, it's going to there, tell me who I send the tax to. And that's probably how it will end up getting implemented, as it is likely to pass both houses of Congress and be signed by the president. That kind of geographic zoning we've also seen present in Google over the years. This is an example of a search on the left on the word Stormfront, which on regular Google leads to Stormfront White Pride World, a neo-Nazi site. And on the right, in Google.de, the German version of Google, ends up just going to Stormfront Studios, not to Stormfront Neo-Nazi. It's just gone. And again, different things offered to different people. Here, interestingly, though, if you go to Germany and you ask for Google.com, it redirects you to Google.de. And then there's a little thing that says, by the way, if you didn't mean it, if somehow you want the real Google, click here. You're just one click away from getting to Google.com, and then you will see the results on the left. And the Germans haven't been upset by that. They might be. They could say, the person is still in Germany. I don't care what you end your domain name with. Don't show them this stuff. But they haven't. And I can only infer that this represents a vision by the German government that says, we want to enforce this law symbolically, and we mean that weightily. It's an important symbolic statement we make that we don't let this stuff, and it's sufficient for the symbolism not to allow it in Google DE around the world, but to, fine, it can stay in Google.com. So a different form of filtering at the source. And similarly here, this is just a video of a detonation of an IED, one of these just sort of amateur videos of something available in many places, but not in the U.S., which led to charges during the Iraq War that somehow YouTube or Google was filtering out information that could somehow affect public opinion on the war. And the answer was much simpler. Anybody uploading a video is actually able to simply regionally restrict and indicate, where would you like to say where the video won't be shown? You know, well, I don't know. Check a box. Let's keep the Israelis away from this. And I was never much for Lesotho. Get rid of Lesotho, that kind of thing. Now, as this becomes possible, this is basically a quova for people. So that even some blogger who says, how dare you go after me in Thailand for putting out a video that insults the Thai king, which I should warn you, concrete takeaway, is illegal in Thailand. I shouldn't have to answer that, because why do I have to be prepared to know everything? And the answer is, well, just don't check Thailand as one of the receiving countries. Put them on the exclusion list, and then you'll be safe. And interestingly, it might lead, over time, to those countries that are the most restrictive and aggressive about going after people they think are violating their laws by throwing cannonballs of internet bits in that they don't like. You might see more and more a default package, almost, like, I'd like to check the package of don't show this in authoritarian countries. And of course, as you start realizing that, you can start making any kind of discriminant. You can say, don't send this to Democrats. Only registered Republicans may view this video. Now, where there'll be leakage around the edges, of course, but it could have symbolic value of the sort that Germany was thinking of. And I wouldn't be too surprised if sooner we see the kinds of tweaking for privacy purposes that Facebook or Google Circles lets you do could start to become, for the stuff we produce and share, extremely finely honed. I only want people who have the following verifiable characteristics to see this kind of thing. Now, the other way in which we see localization of internet is even without the cooperation of a Google or a YouTube or a Facebook or you name it, Yahoo Auctions, we can simply try to filter stuff if we're a sovereign on our turf and do it by either running or influencing our own internet service providers. So this is Jingjing and Cha-Cha, the internet police of the city of Shenzhen. And they have great bromides that they share with people telling them to self-censor. But China also, and others, like here, Saudi Arabia, filter the web. And if you can't get there, it might tell you nothing. It might tell you this, you can't get there. And if you think it's wrong, please explain why you should have the right to see this stuff. And by the way, if we missed a spot, please fill out this other form, and we'll go ahead and filter that too. Now, a lot of that filtering and accompanying surveillance of usage is made possible by private companies that engage in it for a living. This is one such company, Fortinet. They actually denied that they were helping the military government of Myanmar do filtering there until it turns out, this is some research done by our partners at the Citizen Lab in Canada, it turns out here's this guy Benjamin Teh, who is a salesperson for Fortinet, and then we found in the New Light of Myanmar daily newspaper the ceremony where the Fortinet antivirus firewall was introduced. Here he is actually receiving an award for doing it, and part of the firewall is being able to filter sites from any user's view as they go about the internet. And that raises a neat question about portability. And by portability, I mean for any tool that we come up with to make the user experience better, whether we're talking about surfing the internet or whether we're talking about the kinds of geospatial stuff that lie around the corner, that which leads to user autonomy or parental autonomy for children or a library able to keep kids away from something while they're in the reading room, it is going to be vertically portable from one point of control to another. The Saudi Arabian government can declare itself just a big library or a big family, and they're the parents and everybody else is a kid. And you have horizontal portability, so that something that might make sense if implemented under the rule of law and done in one jurisdiction can just too easily be copied and pasted to another jurisdiction. And all it is just one more handshake and transaction. And developing those technologies then has a real problem. So I see the possibility of the kinds of accommodations made for one purpose, copyright takedown, then end up getting used for the period of time that Google was in China before they gave up on it entirely. This is an example of a Google search where they say, well, in accordance with local law, we're not showing you some of the search results. Or in this is MSN Spaces, a Chinese language centric blogging service that people could blog in China. We did an experiment where we typed in Chinese, "I love freedom of speech, human rights, and democracy" as the title of our blog on MSN Spaces, which led to the following error: you must enter a title, it cannot contain profanity, please type a different title. So this is an example of automated filtering tools that, depending on region and jurisdictional preferences, have that kind of horizontal portability. In fairness to MSN Spaces, I should say that despite the heat they got for it, this is one a meme that was going around after Microsoft was doing this on Spaces, I think this is a great example of a bark louder than the bite, because it turned out that you could title any blog entry that. You could write about that all you wanted. You just couldn't title the blog that. And I suspect this might have been one of those things that was like, look, see, we're doing our best here. We're waking up at the crack of noon to make sure no subversive content is posted, while, in fact, we're allowing all sorts of stuff to happen. And for a while, that was Google's argument, too, even as it was filtering search results, that it was still far more permissive than some of the localized search engines. So as we see industry tools coming about to facilitate this kind of stuff, I think there are questions between the public and the private of how we all want to be thinking about the assertion of jurisdiction, because we will be able to shape the global environment into localized variants. And the promise of, say, the uniform resource locator, the URL, you type this link anywhere and it will be the same. That's what makes it uniform. I can give you the link and you've got the same stuff I've got. More and more, that is simply not true. Depending on where you are and where your connection is, you will see something different or not at all compared to somebody else using the same URL. And having a world in which the different sovereigns can now reassert themselves takes away, for those who value it, the kind of libertarian ethos that by default the internet exported when it was being adopted for its economic potential by countries that didn't particularly want the speech potential to come along with it. It is easier to separate those two. And if you are a Westphalian, that's good news. That's about maintaining state sovereignty. and we can come up with something pretty much for everybody in the room for which you would be glad that that is the case. If, on the other hand, you have a certain normative agenda about freedom, that's going to be impacted. And more, it's not just going to be where generally are you, of course, the biometrics and such are going to be pegging you as you and allowing for discrimination, filtering, and such on the basis of that. Now, I suspect over the rest of today and tomorrow, things like Google Glass are going to be discussed, because this is the ultimate in not just having a mobile phone that you check every time, but something linked to that phone that is really part of you as you experience, monocle-wise, the physical world around you. And what happens on your screen of a Google Glass-like device as you meet people will be mediated by a lot of algorithms, by good AI, all for the purpose of serving you. But realize we have horizontal and vertical portability so that this is the kind of thing that's going to be recording where you are at all times and when and what you're seeing, which then could, by warrant or other legal intervention, become simply a surveillance device that has the convenience of use of not requiring those people to go government authorities into a van or otherwise undertake great energy to surveil somebody. And you're going to be given all sorts of data that is going to be specific to who you're meeting, where you are, what you know about the person. And that sort of thing, I think sovereigns are going to want a piece of. Everybody else will, too. It's going to be great for sponsored ads. You want to get his scarf, too, later? Click thumbs up, and we'll put it into your shopping cart ready for purchase, or tell you where the nearest store is. Great liberating stuff like that from a consumer point of view. But who gets to say what's in that feed and what we can make of that individually and collectively? I could know there might be something approaching civil unrest if I see gatherings taking place around this point and all these heads swiveling in a certain direction. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Whatever it is, I'm sending the riot police. This is the kind of thing that I think we'll need to be thinking about as it translates into the more prosaic questions of data ownership, who has access to the stream, data purging, data anonymization. I know LaTanya Sweeney, others will be talking about re-identification. All of these issues converge, and I suspect that what we see on a screen like this, because it is already tailored so much, it might not rankle us or be striking to us if it is further honed because of localization insisted upon by your sovereign, your friendly local sovereign, in a way that's saying, wait a minute, this is a URL, I'm entitled to see it, I'm going to VPN if I have to. I think that internet ethos may not carry over into this new space. For some, that's a feature. For others, that's going to be a bug. Thank you very much. Sure, I'd be happy to. Questions, comments, objections, thoughts? And nobody likes to be the first one to ask a question, but it will soon get awkward enough that somebody's going to take one for the team.
Jonathan, I'll ask one. First, that was a fantastic talk, and I appreciate your perspective and bringing in the history of internet law and you know, how it's going to fit going forward. Can you discuss a little bit
Can you discuss a little bit what role technology, what role the law, and what role education do you think they will each play as we move forward? What role they played in the internet to sort of deal with these things? Because I think all three have a part.
Yeah. Well, education is very interesting, and I'd probably rephrase that as norms. What will become the expectations of use around things? And if past waves of technology that feels clunky and intrusive but then becomes everywhere are any indication, the water always finds its lowest level, that the imperative of being able to look at your cell phone because this just in means more and more people just dine with the phone physically in front of them at the table in case they need to glance their glance downward and see that, you know, a Facebook friend just posted an update that they're at dinner sitting across from you. And with something like Google Glass, which is really a synthesis of trying to bring your social stuff to bear, bringing the geo stuff to bear, including who's near you. And you walk into a restaurant, maybe you don't know anybody there, you can say, are any of the 10 closest friends of my 10 closest friends there? And if you calculate them not to be recently indicted for something, I wouldn't mind saying hello. That's the kind of app that you could see appearing almost instantly on that platform for which it will feel utterly naked to walk around without it. So on the education front, it's less about how to push people on safe uses and more about what uses are they naturally going to acclimatize to, and if you wanted them from a societal standpoint to avoid certain uses, how can we devise the technology to kind of siphon them away from that? And there's a lot of, I think, even on our speakers list and among the audience, there are human factors, HCI, UX designers who think a lot about that, that education should be plugged directly into the limbic system, nudging, rather than remember these helpful 25 rules before you use your new device. And that's great, but it's also a form of very subtle regulation. And in fact, this now relates to your other two areas, the technology and the law. The law that just simply tells you not to do something is very old-fashioned. And it was Larry Lessig and Joel Rydenberg, among others, who told us early on that if you really want to make a law effective in this technological space, require that the intermediaries embed and enforce it, preferably automatically. And when it's done, it's much harder to protest against. You just see it as part of the furniture of the room rather than seeing it as somebody in your face telling you you can't do something. It's an advantage for those who want to use it as a vehicle for salutary regulation. It is something really to keep an eye out for regulation that may go beyond the pale by whatever metric we have for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One other question before you can answer it, as they come down. Fair enough.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about whether you feel the geographic segmentation applies to privacy as well, or is that so amorphous in the past that it's a different regime?
Well, one insight is that the kinds of choices people might want to make and vindicate that they call privacy choices are technologically not that far away from the kinds of choices publishers might want to make about who can read what they write or view what they produce. Namely, those who paid for it can see it and those who didn't can't, or Republicans this, Democrats this. All of it is a form of rights or preferences management. And I see that both as promising for privacy vindication, if we can come up with stuff that is as easy as water to swim in to implement, rather than a very complicated drop-down, privacy can be vindicated. On the other hand, if the defaults are set certain ways and kids today kind of thing get used to it, they will see the downsides of privacy only when it comes back to bite them, rather than in those earlier times when maybe it wouldn't be a good idea to absolutely record and broadcast everything you're doing to everyone.